Welcome to the Cascadian Prophets Podcast, a production of the Cascadia Poetics Lab, empowering people to practice poetry and deepen connections to place, self, and the present moment.
Imagine growing up a poet in a state like Wisconsin and having to travel to Colorado to learn about the work of Loreen Nedeker, and furthermore, to have one's own consciousness changed by engagement with her work. Nedeker's work, since her death in 1970, has exploded in popularity beyond any expectation anyone might have had while she was alive. Her intensely crafted, condensed, and place-centric poems of her native Wisconsin and longtime home Black Hawk Island near Fort Atkinson garnered her some regional attention while she was alive, but her work is now a veritable cottage industry, with much scholarship being done on her oeuvre. Nicholas Gulig is the poet laureate of Wisconsin, and he is that poet who only learned about Nedeker moving away from the eat cheese or die state. He's our guest today to talk poetry, Nedeker, and what connection to place can mean in a disconnected and distracted time. Nicholas, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
Tell us about that time where here you are in grad school, I'm guessing.
Yeah, in Denver.
And you hear about Loreen Nedeker, and you're probably like, why didn't anyone tell me about her?
Well, I was, I forget the name of the particular course that I was taking. My professor was Eleni Siklianos, and Wave Books had just put out the edition of Lake Superior, which included the poem in its entirety. It's a fairly long poem as far as poems go. It included her notes. Nedeker took extensive notes. And it included some essays as well as the transcript of her kind of travel log that she kept when she and her husband Al circumnavigated Lake Superior. I forget the date exactly, mid-60s, towards the end of her life, towards the end of her career. Even now, I'm always surprised when things that are familiar to me, when things that are close to home, and Lake Superior is close to home. I grew up in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Lake Superior is not far from Eau Claire, and it's a place that if you live in the north of Wisconsin, or even the middle north of Wisconsin, Lake Superior is a place that you go up traveling to for family vacations, et cetera, when you're young. It's a fairly affordable trip for families who can't afford to go to more exotic places. And I'm always surprised when places that are very close to me, that are familiar to me, that feel like home to me, find their way or make their appearances in a part of my life that feels very, very far away from home, or at least the poetry world felt very like a very different hemisphere than the part of the world that I grew up. It felt like a different life. The person that I am and have been moving around in the poetry world feels almost divorced from the place that I grew up in. So I'm always surprised when something like Lake Superior, when something like a poet from Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin pops up, it feels out of place. I'm like, what are you doing here? What is all this attention to Lake Superior doing in my poetry studies class? And I think secretly deep down, despite all its problems, I'm proud to be from Wisconsin, somewhat quietly proud to be a Midwesterner, but I am proud to be a Midwesterner. And it was just a spark of joy to feel and see this room full of wildly creative, wildly talented, wildly intelligent, future poets of America diving into this space, which was Loreen Nedeker's Lake Superior, which it felt to me that suddenly and for the first time, people cared about the things that I deep down cared about and that I had maybe been nervous or hesitant or reticent to kind of openly care about.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I grew up in Chicago, so I did the math one time, and I've been to Fort Atkinson and seen the tiny, tiny cabin that she lived in for a while, and then the house closer to the river that's bigger and on stilts because the river is still somewhat wild. And knowing that someone like that, with that kind of depth of gesture, not only lived basically her whole life about 100 miles from my house, but related to this place with this great deal of love and affection.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I grew up on the northwest side of Chicago, so about, you know, a 10-minute walk from the forest preserves. And compared to the old-growth forests of Cascadia, it's like, you know, this is nothing to write about. Yet she wrote about it. She connected with it. And to go downtown in Fort Atkinson and see her poems on mm-hmm. the side of buildings and stuff is a real beautiful thing.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. Let me ask you, there was a Solitary Plover article. This is the newsletter of
yes.
the Loreen Nideker Society. And you had this quote, "Of all people, it's ironic that Loreen Nideker would be the one to teach me how to leave myself behind and reach for other people." Tell us yeah. what you mean by that.
When I think about, and I've, in the this last year, especially since becoming the Poet Laureate of Wisconsin, I've had many opportunities to think extensively about Nideker's effect on me as a person, and I guess more specifically on me as a writer. And it isn't what I think you would think it is. I think that one would think that Loreen grants me permission to talk about my place in the world, which she does, but I don't know that that's really, I don't know that that's the heart of it. It wasn't her subject matter so much. It wasn't the fact that, or even the fact that she was an outsider to this, you know, to the world of experimental poetry, which I too have oftentimes felt like an outsider to that world. It was more, for me, it was more how her process and her approach helped me to kind of redefine my relationship to the poem. It helped to help me to reimagine what a poet was and what a poem could be at a particular time in my career when I'm in the middle of a PhD program. I'm approaching like the end of the amount of times that I can postpone like stepping foot out of academia into the real world. And I've been writing poetry for, you know, at that point, close to 25 years or so, and had become very, very exhausted with myself. I'd become very, very, I think most artists go through this, I'd become very, very predictable to myself. I could almost see the poems that I was writing before I wrote them. And I'd ceased to surprise myself. I'd ceased to love my own work, which is something that you need to do, especially when you're trafficking in a medium where there isn't a lot of applause for poets. There isn't a lot of external validation. And I'd lost the ability to sustain that in myself. And then I read Lake Superior. And here was a woman from the part of the world that I was from, who, like me, was on the outskirts of the medium, who was approaching the poem completely differently than I had been taught to approach it and that I had been approaching it for the vast majority of my time as a poet. I think, like a lot of people, I grew up under the kind of influence of a narrative that positioned poetry as self-expression, which is to say that the source of the poem is here, and I'm pointing to my, you know, pointing my heart, or I'm pointing to the soul, or that the poem happens inside of you and then works its way out of you. So it begins within the individual. I think that's a inheritance from the romantic lyric tradition or something like that. And Nideker was different. For her, the poem, a poem like Lake Superior, started as an act of research. She worked in a library. She spent, you know, months, maybe even years. She would travel to Milwaukee because they had a better library, just to do research on geology, just to do research on indigenous history related to the Lake Superior region. And I don't know why exactly, but that blew my mind at that particular place and point in time. Because what that said to me was that the poem actually can start outside of the self, that the poem could start, well, if you think about what research is an act of curiosity. And it begins by saying and admitting that I don't know, that there's something that I don't understand, and it's out there. It's not in me. And so I need to leave myself and go find the people, the scholars, the researchers, the biologists, the historians, etc., that they have the thing that I need to write the poem. I don't have it. It's not here. It's in the hearts and minds and efforts and work of other people. And that was a complete inversion of my relationship to poetry. And once I read a poem that moved me, that was written in that way, it changed how I thought about the poem. It changed how I thought about what a poet was. And it was that revision at that time in my life, which was so influential, and that I've been working in the aftermath of that kind of that inversion of poem, of that inversion of the relationship between poet and poem ever since. And I don't know how to thank her except to keep writing. I don't know how to thank her. I do owe her I owe her more gratitude, obviously, than I'm able to give to someone who's no longer alive. And I think that too, that in and of itself, how is writing a form of, or how is the poem a form of gratitude to the people that we can't say thank you to? That too is a kind of different relationship to the notion of literary inheritance, right? Like we come out of a tradition in which it's the anxiety of influence that our literary ancestors of people that we have to fight with and like struggle and wrestle with to come out of their shadow to arrive at something that's original. I think with Nitocker, and by extension, all of my literary ancestors, I want a way of relating to them that's more cooperative and more an effort of expressing gratitude than it is of trying to get out from under a shadow.
Honorific.
Yeah,
Yeah,
exactly.
yeah.
Yeah.
Mind blown by Nitocker is what you're saying, really. And
Absolutely.
you're talking about that old impulse from the Romantic era, which Charles Olson, in his essay Projective Verse, described as the private soul at any public wall,
Yeah.
right? So it was probably time for that tradition to go, and he recognized it. Early as 1950, and Pound certainly before that. You recreated her road trip around Lake Superior. Tell
I
us about
did,
that.
yeah.
Yeah.
I've done it twice now. I did it once pre-COVID, and then COVID kind of killed the project because we could no longer cross over into Canada. And then when I became the poet laureate, it provided me the opportunity to breathe new life into that project. And so I went the second time with a group of other writers, my colleague, the essayist Barrett Swanson, his wife, the essayist Megan O'Giblin, came with me, as did a film producer named Colin, probably from PBS Wisconsin, and a kind of childhood friend, my friend Riley, who came because he had a drone and we wanted to take drone footage of the lake and everything around the lake, etc. And I brought Megan and Barrett with me because I had the idea that while they weren't of the same age as Laureen and her husband Al were, I wanted some sort of visual representation of a couple moving around the lake, etc. And so they came, and my editor, my last editor, Carol Pagel, came also because she's working on a collection of essays about Laureen Nitocker. And so I thought, I was like, well, Carol, you should come too. Like you can work this into your project. Like let my project be an opportunity for your project, et cetera. And so we traveled the lake together. We did this trip in the reverse order that Laureen did it, only because my friend Barrett had to be at a bachelor party close to Duluth at the time that we were going on the trip. So it made sense for us to start kind of at the end of the trip and work our way towards the beginning of the trip. And what we were doing essentially is I was thinking I was thinking about what was the word you used, like honor,
Honorific.
honorific.
Yeah.
I was thinking about how do I honor the honorific relationship that I feel to Nitaker? And I was teaching a course on the aesthetics of grief that semester. So I'd spent the summer thinking about grief and aesthetics related to grief. And part of that planning for that class had to do with thinking and looking into the tradition of altar making, which is something that many cultures do to honor people who have passed on. For example, my father passed away in 2015, and there's still an altar in my mother's house or in my parents' house, where his picture is, where the objects that were important to him are kind of, arranged on this altar. My mother keeps, a vase of flowers, a kind of she's kept a vase of flowers alive on that altar since he died in 2015. On holidays, she puts bits and pieces of the Christmas meal or the Easter meal up on the altar, etc. And as I've thought about what an altar is, to me, the construction of an altar operates in two directions at once. It looks back. It's a way to pay tribute to the past in which the person was present, right? We're honoring the life that they lived while they were alive. We're putting photographs of my father when he was young up on the altar. We're putting objects that he cared about, a compass that he would take when he would go fishing in Canada, for example. We're honoring this past. So the altar is looking backward as a way to say thank you for the life that you lived while you were alive. But we construct it in order to move forward into the future without that person. It's also a practice that helps us let the person go. And so the altar to me seems like it's moving in two directions. We're saying thank you for the past in order to let go of that past and move ahead into the world without that person there. And so what I wanted to do on that trip was collect, I wanted to revisit the places that Laureen and her husband Al visited on that trip. And I had access to a lot of those places via the extensive notes that she took, the journal that she kept while she was on that trip. So we were able to go to many of the places that we know historically she went to. And while we were there at those places, and while we were driving around the lake and stopping by the lake and walking the shores of Lake Superior, et cetera, we collected objects that I imagined would have caught her eye, objects that she would have valued, that she maybe herself would have collected, 50 years ago when she took that trip. And we collected those objects as we went around the lake. And on our last day on the lake, we constructed an altar of all the kind of detritus, kind of primarily natural detritus, leaves, branches, flowers, stones, apples. We found an apple tree on the shore at the end of the lake, mushrooms, all these things. And we had been carrying a picture of her with us, and we constructed this altar for Nitaker on the shores of Lake Superior after following in her footsteps. And this to me was felt like a really important gesture to say thank you to this poet who in many ways returned poetry to me and in many ways returned my state to me, and whose work became a central activity that has allowed my career to kind of blossom or move in the direction that it has. I received a Poet Laureate Fellowship from the Academy of American Poets based on a project proposal that involved traveling around Lake Superior and building this altar for Nitaker and engaging her work and making her work more accessible to people in Wisconsin. And that fellowship's a big deal. It's financially a big deal. It's put me in touch with people like you. I don't know that you and I'd be talking right now if that hadn't happened, et cetera. And so it felt important to build an altar to say thank you and to say I'm grateful and to say now I'm moving. Once I complete this project, I'm going to move on. That to me feels like a much healthier way of relating to our ancestral inheritance, our literary, the people to whom we are indebted.
Very interesting because in that solitary plover article, you also write, all writing acts as altars act.
I think writing at its best, not, I mean, I wouldn't say all writing, but I think the writing that to me strikes me as being successful acts that way. Or I should say, the writing that I want to write for it to succeed, at least right now, at this moment in my aesthetic journey, that's the way that I want my language to operate. I want the poem to act as altars act.
Can you elaborate on that?
So again, I think it has to do with moving in two directions. And that feels important because it's really important to me as a poet working in 2024 in the world as it is right now, for the poem to be as many things at once as it can be. Because that to me, or the complexity of something that isn't singular or reducible to a singular interpretation or reducible to a singular sense of identity feels incredibly important right now in a world where the vast majority of the cultural products that the culture produce seem flat to me and have for quite some time. And I think by flat, I simply mean easily accessible, easily reproducible, easily consumable, and easily forgettable. And that ease of reproduction, that ease of consumption, that ease by which we consume things and forget about them the next day in order to consume the next thing feels very definitive of the culture at this particular place and point in time. And I worry very much that poetry will succumb to that because I think the driving force behind that trajectory in cultural products is a capitalist force, and I don't know that there's anything that cannot be appropriated by capitalism, even the things that actively try to resist it, that resistance itself becomes appropriated and packaged and repackaged and sold, et cetera. And so an art that can be as many things at once, to me right now feels kind of like the last stand or something like that. And so when I say that I want a poem to move in two directions, I think that's part of what I'm saying at a more kind of abstract conceptual level. That idea of a piece of art moving in two directions at once isn't mine. I'm stealing that from the musician John Coltrane, right, who says that when he writes, when he's writing a song, he's trying to write a sentence that moves in two directions at once. So I'm kind of taking, again, I'm borrowing something from this musician who's been super important to me and trying to think of what might that look like in my medium? What might that look like in poetry?
Yeah, altar almost as place a fulcrum between past and intended future, but also the honorific aspect of it, because so much in our culture and so much in our writing culture is this kind of sardonic detachment that, this irony, which it should be one tool that each poet should have in their bag, but put too much in and the gumbo starts tasting rather bitter.
Yeah, agree.
There was something you brought up about research that Nitager did on the indigenous. And if you look at Lake Koshkonong, which is the lake that Black Hawk Island, not really an island, a peninsula, is surrounded by, something that surrounds the lake are all these indigenous mounds. And Wisconsin, part of the mound building culture that I think was centered in Cahokia, Illinois, and created the highest point in Illinois is Dixon Mound, which is 1,200 feet.
And there are kind of suburbs of that civilization in Lake Mills, you know, which is not far from here. Yeah.
It seems to me that, you know, D.H. Lawrence, I don't know if you know this about his connection with Whitman, but he called Walt Whitman the first white Aboriginal. And obviously is an honorific. And I see that Laureen might be the second because she chose to plant her flag there at Black Hawk Island, surrounded by these Indian mounds. Mm-hmm. And there's got to be something potent about that area if the indigenous people spent such time creating these sacred places.
Yeah, I mean, I would need to talk to an indigenous historian about that to kind of understand more clearly what those mounds meant to those people in those particular places in those particular times. But to me, speaking somewhat innocently about it, they seem like altars. They seem like altars to me. And I don't know if Laureen would frame her work in that way or not. I would have to talk to someone who's spent more time with their scholarly cap on thinking about Nidaker. But I think that's a really good question to see, like, in what ways did she see her work as altar making? I think I should ask around.
It seems to me there's a connection, and she may not have been connected to indigenous people or indigenous thinking per se, but the way that she lived her life seemed to me to have had a lot of similarities in that.
Right? And I think she was also limited, however, by what history was at that particular place and point in time too, right? She was working with historical sources that were very like Anglo-centric accounts of history as such, right? You know, all this work has happened since 1964 or whatever in terms of indigenous history. But she was working with the tools that she had. She was working with what was available to a person living in the swamps, you know, in the swamps at the outskirts of a town that itself is at the outskirts of towns, which are themselves at the outskirts of towns. Like Black Hawk Island is the middle of nowhere. And she was going to great lengths to learn as much as she could. I mean, again, she was traveling to Milwaukee just to sit in a library and read and to teach herself.
Whereas others in her neighborhood might have gone to Milwaukee at that same time to go see a John Wayne movie.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Let me ask you about her connection to place, your connection to place, and what connection to place means in a disconnected and distracted time.
I don't know that I can speak authoritatively about what it meant to her. I can say that right now and for the recent past, I try to see my place in terms of its relationship to the global context. For me, thinking about regionality and the local sphere, the local community, thinking about personal locality, because the places where we live are a part of us, there is a kind of interiority to the local community that you live in. Thinking about Fort Atkinson or thinking about Wisconsin is a way of thinking about myself. But as we talked about earlier, the self as the source of the poem, or I may say as the sole source of the poem, is no longer very interesting to me. Maybe it will become again later, but right now it's not. And so when I was working on Orient, I think I was asking myself, like, if I do have that relationship to self, if I do understand that it's limited, what can I do to make it less so? One thing I'm not sure that I can do is escape it. I don't know, maybe this is because I'm not a very good Buddhist, but I don't know that we can escape the self. And so that's a problem, right? Like the self, I don't want it to be the sole source of the poem, but I also don't believe that I can escape it. So what do I do? What can one do? And I wanted in that book, I wanted to test the extent to which the losses that I was experiencing here, for example, the loss of my father, right, which is a very local, individualized form of loss, how can that be understood as a lens or a door or an opening through which the losses of other people to whom I am very, very far, to people who feel very, very distant to me, people on the other side of the world who are experiencing losses that are all but alien to someone living in Wisconsin. How can my losses be an opening towards other people that allows their losses to be less imaginary? Because even though I know in reality those lives are real and that those losses are real, they don't feel real to me because I have no real way of understanding what, like, think about right now, like, what does a child in Gaza feel right now? That's completely imaginary to me. I have no real rope of connection except to think about how to try to wrestle and turn my, what I do feel as real, the loss of my father, for example, how can that be a lens to help me understand what's happening around the world? At the time that I was writing Orient, I was thinking primarily of the civil war in Syria, which was the kind of catastrophe, the most dramatic form of human suffering that was populating my newsfeed and that was coming across my television and entering my life through various forms of media. And so when I think about place, it's inseparable from self. I want to think of poetry as a language that emerges in order to make those two things closer.
Michael McClure, in his book, Scratching the Beat Surface, said, "The way to the universal is by means of the most intensely personal." And I think that's what you're getting at.
Yeah, I mean, we get a version of that. I mean, in some ways, like, I think poetry, more I think about, like, I think poetry is the tools that are at the heart of the poet's toolbox. Say the image, for example, right? Like, what is poetry if not sometimes reaching into the toolbox and trying to create an image in order to make your poem? The image, the way that Robert Haas talks about the image in his essay Images, is he says, I'm paraphrasing here, so don't quote me. He says, the image is the place where that which perishes and that which lasts forever come into contact, right? It's the confluence of that which is temporary. And by what he means by that which perishes, I think he means that which is material, that which is right there in front of you, the light at this hour, the tree in front of your house, the leaf that's laying on the sidewalk, right? Because a second later, the wind is going to come and blow that leaf away, and it has perished. It's gone. It's never going to be in that particular moment, in that particular way, in that particular light again, right? And so that's like zooming in, right? And then that grants us access to that which lasts forever, that I can, if I look close enough at the tree outside my window, I can learn something about love, right? And love is, of course, something that's the eternal, that's what lasts forever. So I think the image too, or a lot of the tools that we have as poets are kind of operating or trying to operate like that. They're trying to teach us that, or they're offering those tools and strategies, are offering themselves as opportunities to see and understand and move through the world in that way.
Amen. I'd love it if you'd share some work with us. You said a poem, a recent poem, so we can get some sense. Very un-Nidecker-like, because the lines are sprawling and gigantic. But it would be nice to hear that. Tell us about it.
So I believe the poem you're talking about is Ometidia. And that's a biology term that has to do with the visionary system of bees. Because he asked for a poem about Nidecker, and I don't have any poems about Nidecker, but I have poems that were influenced by her. And again, not by her subject matter so much, but by her approach to researching the poem, to starting with research as a source, and then blending the personal with research. And the extent to which a poem like Lake Superior, or a poem like Wintergreen Ridge, which is another like heavily researched poem that occurs in a location, in that case, Door County, are kind of stitched together, that they feel like collages to me, where she's taking, here's a fact that I learned when I was researching agates. And then here's a fragment from my travel journal. And then here's a sentence from my notes on Indigenous history. And she's kind of collaging these things together to form the lines and to form the stanzas. And so this poem, Ometidia, I was borrowing those approaches from her. I was borrowing research, and I was choosing events from my own life. So in this poem, Ometidia, I'm doing research on the poet John Keats. So it's a kind of like critical kind of literary theory kind of form of research. And I'm doing research into the biology of bees and the way that bees see the lifespan of bees. And then I'm creating language from memory, from a kind of, again, I'm trying to think of like, how is the self connected to, you know, occurrences in other places? And so I'm thinking of the riots in Minneapolis following the George Floyd lynching. And then I'm also drawing on a memory in which my daughter and I are planting a garden, and also a kind of recollection of a friend that I lost for a few years to the prison system. And so I'm looking at all these separate places, diving into them, trying to create language that are sourced in these different moments, and then trying to kind of weave or collage all of that language together to create this new thing.
You think it would be helpful to share screen so folks can read along, because it's kind of dense?
Yeah, it's dense and it's long. You sure you want me to read this thing in its entirety?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, people can tune out when they want to tune out.
All right.
I think it's good after all the discussion to get a sense of your work. I think would be very helpful.
All right. The poem is called Ometidia. In Keats's letters, the poet makes a specter of his aesthetics. Beauty should obliterate. As the riots burn in Minneapolis, I plant bee balm with my daughter in our yard. Because my friend in prison helps white supremacists write letters to their lovers and blinks himself to sleep, the police lights rising from the streets like little tongues beyond the dead insistence of their song, upend the dumb capacity for grace. What must we forgive? To see a single flower in a field of other flowers, Keats insists that we abandon our identity. The lynching ruptured everything. To sustain the colony, a worker bee goes forth in early light and lingers. Sitting in the grass, we listen. The drone of tiny wings adrift between the patchwork patterning of violets, a kind of language glittering. At first, she's afraid. When the open field between a thesis and its antithesis evaporates, Keats insists the arguments regarding art begin to dovetail in the mind. I want to think that he is right. The light of a convergence arriving on an altar I imagine centered somewhere in me like a soul. The city burning on a live stream while I send messages to friends illuminates my living room. When my daughter pushes seeds into the dirt, she asks if she is hurting it. A violent brightness casts a dark catastrophe across the wall. Capable of seeing ultraviolet light, the sun, despite the clouds, the compound eyes of bees are covered with tiny follicles that sense the wind's direction. A disquisition, not dispute, on a myriad of subjects strikes me. I try to write a letter to my friend and find myself among a numb cacophony of distances, admitting my mistakes. What is true enough to render? This, for Keats, is the burden of the mystery, a liberating doubt. When my daughter asks if cops are bad, I grab her hand and say that in the morning we'll check to see if anything has sprouted. This, pursued through volumes, eliminates the call of all consideration. How beautiful the retired roses folding over in the night wind breaking. How fact and reason seem to fall away. My faith in people, the pistol and the stigma and the seed. When the workers first emerge, their hair is edged in silver and their wings are soft, paper thin and crumbled. I tire early in the aftermath and think it sad that the specific composition of omotidia varies between organisms, the world appearing differently as a matter of blind mechanics. When I drive across the country to see my friend in the Elkton Federal Correctional Institution, I stand in a line of children in the jail yard waiting with their mothers to see their dads. All of us are earth dark. I find I cannot exist, says Keats. It is easier to say what poems should be than write them. And so I find myself suspended in a landscape made of years and long apologies. In the prison cafeteria, my friend says the thing that shocks him most is how illiterate the inmates are. Queen bees brood their eggs like birds and place them in a pollen ball. When my daughter comes home from school, she asks if the police would ever hurt her mother, and then we sit in silence. The silence ruptures us, the thing we cannot see that enters slowly through the ear and lingers, a wilderness approaching the immediate emergency of wreck, not a self so much a subject. Thus, the music of the poem is what the mouth becomes when language leans into uncertainty. Landscape is imaginary. Every morning when I wait in line in the Luther Elementary parking lot, among the other parents dropping off their kids, I count the thin blue line police flags plastered to the metal bumpers of their trucks. Colonies exist to feed the queen's demand for sweetness, and this too is a kind of silence lingering. I want to tell my daughter about the summer I was 17 in Minneapolis, a punk show at a venue called the Bomb Shelter. How the cops came in and punched the brown kid standing next to me. In my memory, my mind goes blank on impact, my body acting on its own. For the first time, I find myself beyond myself, the crowd erupting all around me and spilling out into the streets of the same precinct burning on my phone today, some 20-odd years later. I want to tell her that my friends together picked me off the ground and took me to the hospital, but instead I tell my students that the poet is at once the possessor and the possessed, the colonizer and the colonized, and that for Keats, language, when it is working, takes away your name. It surprises me to learn that bees have five eyes, three of which see only shadow, but not the shape that casts it. Maybe this is beautiful. Vision is diverse. Oh, for a life of sensation rather than of thought. Every autumn, the flowers we have planted start to fall apart, folding inward toward a center that is only partially there. My friend is out of prison. He's married now and has a daughter of his own. Every month, he sends me records in the mail with little notes explaining his experience of song. since an image from the compound eye is created from a set of independent elements, bees can only see that part of the picture directly there in front of them. It is difficult to know the world as someone other than yourself, to sense through nothing more than shadow there is in you a garden somewhere planted by a stranger, where the spirit you imagine passing through you glides against another person's body like a ghost. Keats believes that if the poem does not come naturally, like leaves to a tree in spring, it should not come at all. The riots rise and fall around my daughter like a century. The average lifespan of a worker bee is 6 to 7 weeks. My dreams do not relieve me. In time, as the workers cross the distance from one flower to another, heading home to feed the queen, their wings deteriorate, battered by a wind that used to carry them. Laughing in a pool of pollen-colored light, my daughter sings my name and arranges yellow petals in a circle at my feet. In the chamber of our maiden thought, Keats forewarns a darkening. The police are everywhere. My daughter tells me I am standing in the sun.
Oh, man. That's incredible.
Thank you.
And what an honor it is for me to be able to have access to a person who 30 minutes ago was a stranger, and now I feel, you know, at least an acquaintanceship, if not a friendship with, because of the depth of the intimacy of this conversation. And that's a testament to your dedication to the craft and to your humility. And I give thanks for that. And I honor you for that. And I thank you for taking time.
It's also a testament to your questions. Like you're good at this. I do a lot of interviews. You're good at this.
Thanks. Well, it's a joy. You know, it's a joy to do it and to be able to meet people like you. What a blessing it is. So I thank you. I point people to your article in the current edition of The Solitary Plover. And I hope that our paths cross again, Nick Gulig.
Me too. Thank you, Paul.
Stay well, man.
Take care. Have a good one.
Cascadian Profit supporters include Diana Elser, a sponsorship dedicated to her parents, whose practicality, humor, and love of family life reflected their experience in and love for the Missouri Breaks and Ruby Valley, Montana landscapes that define their childhoods. And Steinbrook Native Gallery, located near Pike Place Market in downtown Seattle, featuring fine art of the Northwest Coast from emerging and established artists. A link to their site at cascadianprofits.org. Cascadian Profits is a production of the Cascadia Poetics Lab, founded in 1993. More interviews and lots of information on our website, cascadianprofits.org.